You are listening to the Dark Corner Podcast with DJ Evil Dave and Starfleet International Lieutenant Commander Brady. Folks, recording at an odd time on a Monday while Brandy is away taking care of her mother. And I'm not sure when I'm going to be able to get Brandy on again with her added duties, as Picard would say it. So, just to fly solo for a while until I can get her on to talk about the next card in the tarot. So it's kind of racking my brain. Or is it brains? Brain? Brains? Racking my brains to come up with a topic for discussion. And since role-playing is really probably more popular than it's ever been at the moment, I thought I'd go through the list of tabletop role-playing games I've played and kind of share my thoughts. And that would be the focus for this episode. Before that, of course, we have some news and reviews. In news, Saturday morning, I think right around the time Brandy was getting ready to go down to her mom's, we heard a boom, almost like thunder, but not quite. It turns out what we heard was the sonic boom of a meteor entering the atmosphere over Salt Lake County. It had, yes, broken the sound barrier and made such a noise that we heard it as far north as Ogden. There is a little buzz about it on Twitter, but nothing all too serious. So it doesn't seem like it actually impacted or anything. It seemed to have burned up in the atmosphere, but what a strange way to greet the morning on a Saturday. And just as these recent years have been going, I wouldn't be too surprised if a meteor did strike. But not in this instance. Yeah, it was quite remarkable just to hear a boom and then to find out what it was through Twitter. If the meteor had strucken us, then we wouldn't be able to go to the next thing in news, and that is that Brandy and I submitted a panel idea to FanX, that is the big comic book and pop culture entertainment, you know, science fiction fantasy convention in Salt Lake City. But yes, we had a panel accepted in which we will be discussing emotional intelligence in Star Trek Discovery and the spin-off show Strange New Worlds. I'm wondering if I'll be able to record the panel. Should be able to, as Brandy and I will probably be sitting pretty close to one another, and if I were to put a phone between us, then it's likely we could capture our conversation and post it as the podcast. But I'm excited. She's excited. She loves talking about Star Trek. And she likes me to be like a soundboard to bounce off ideas or to discuss things. And I tend to bring a different perspective to these conversations. So it should be a pretty fun panel. I know we're going to probably get some Discovery haters, maybe. But, you know, that's something we can address. Because, yeah, the emotional intelligence behind Star Trek Discovery, I think, is why a lot of people don't get on with it. It's a different way of presenting heroes. It's kind of a very Gen Z approach to modern heroism. It's being able to openly discuss your feelings or to reflect how issues come up when you don't. Also, I've been developing a solo Dungeons & Dragons campaign for Brandy, kind of creating a world that is influenced and controlled by a thing called prestige, which gets corrupted into what is essentially the patriarchy, and she can lead kind of a rebel force against it. It's kind of the modern era in which we live. It might be nice to play out some, you know, some fantastical occasions where one can live out fighting against this patriarchal system. Still kind of working on the world-building aspects, but once I determined the whole prestige angle, everything else seems to be falling into place. I was having that kind of writer's block thing where either there were too many ideas or no ideas, and just the endless possibilities was kind of hampering creativity. So I just popped onto Google and did a random word generator. Just pick one word out of the many words, and it picked prestige. And once I kind of contemplated what that word meant, it kind of fell into place. Everything else just came from there. This idea of assigning prestige as an award to heroes and then having those with prestige not want to give up that prestige and wanting to pass it down generationally and beginning to corrupt and change the way prestige is handed out until you develop this seat of power that is designed to keep, withhold, generate, control prestige in such a fashion that the system is unchanging. It becomes kind of authoritarian. You have some resistance fighters trying to restore the ways of old, or perhaps just completely toppling the system and replace it with something else entirely. So I have to work out how to kind of gear a D&D campaign for a single player. I'll probably have, I've already figured that she can have some followers that assist her so that things don't get overwhelming, that you have still that skill set you get with the party, adventuring party system. So, you know, it's not dependent on one person to do everything. But it'll be probably a little while before we start doing that. I don't think we'll ever do it on the show. Just something to help scratch that itch he's been wanting to play, and I do enjoy DMing. In reviews for movie night, Brandy had us watch Lightyear, and we really enjoyed it. It was surprisingly scientific, dealing with time dilation and approaching light speed and all that sort of thing. Kind of retcons a little bit some of the aspects that we know of from Toy Story regarding the universe of Buzz Lightyear. Otherwise, we found it engaging, touching at times, like Pixar generally is. Interesting, like the sci-fi aspects of it were intriguing, and we enjoyed the little robot cat companion. So we had a good time. Brandy got me listening to yet another podcast. I'm listening to Morbid, which is another true crime podcast done by Ashley, and I think the other one's name is Elena? Aha, yes, Elena. Ashley is a hairstylist. Elena is an autopsy tech, and together they talk about serial killers, haunted places, weird mysteries. They did an episode on torture devices, and very similar to My Favorite Murder, it's kind of a way of them dealing with their anxiety around these issues. In fact, I think one of Ashley's common phrases is that she's not okay when Elena's discussing something. They kind of trade back and forth what they're talking about. They're naturally funny people, engaging, really enjoy their fans and relate to them well. They're from the Boston area. But yeah, the Morbid podcast, I've been enjoying it and trying to catch up. There's a lot of episodes, so it's going to be quite the long road getting from here to there. But I look forward to catching up. We also started watching Sandman, finally, and we are both enjoying it. I found the first episode to be quite the way to open a series of showing how the Dream of the Endless loses his kingdom, more or less, and then the rest of the series can be how he gradually restores it. I do have some issues with Neil Gaiman. I think he can't write subtext. Everything he writes is textual, super textual even, like American Gods, that episode of Doctor Who, The Doctor's Wife. There's not much metaphor. Everything is like A to A. There's no A to B, really. But I think that works okay in this format, because we're already dealing with kind of a heightened reality, almost, well, really a fantasy world where, you know, there is a King of Dreams. My understanding is that Sandman was already a DC character that nobody was doing anything with, so Neil Gaiman came in and asked if he could take over the project, and this is what he did with it. He did something very literary, and we're very much enjoying it, looking forward to seeing more episodes together, even though there's so much else we're still backed up on. I think I'll leave it there for news and reviews and get into the dark track. So Deep Six is a short-lived garage rock band from America. They only recorded one album, yet they still did a radio session for Brave New Waves, which is where this song comes from, the Canadian Broadcasting Channel program devoted to new wave music. And so here is this odd little garage band, Deep Six, performing Basement. Kind of eerie how that starts. You can feel some kind of experimentalism going on. You play like a record and then lead from that into the song itself, which has that kind of late era garage rock meets psychedelic sound. Very lo-fi, lots of reverb in there. Good groove. I think a pretty solid band, and I think kind of fitting for what we're going to be discussing as the main topic.
The Dice Girls may not know what we're doing, but we're sure having a lot of fun doing it.
Do my bagpipes have, like, attack damage? If I take out my bow, could I miss and hit Trigus?
If you roll bad enough.
Have we been able to see the whole time?
You have dark vision! Surprise!
What ho, ugly creature?
Don't mind him.
Everyone's dying around me, but I can't hit anything!
Are you guys gonna be okay?
Honestly, I think the answer to that is always no.
Who are you?
I'm just some riffraff.
Not anything particularly special.
We are the Dice Girls.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
I rolled a 4, we're gonna die.
Alright, so the main topic is tabletop role-playing games. I've played a lot of them, going back probably as early as 1980, maybe 1981, but I'm probably correct with 1980. The first role-playing game I remember playing was a science fiction one. It wasn't Dungeons & Dragons, as I think most people's first experience would be. A friend of mine at the time brought to school with him a science fiction themed role-playing game. I think it might have been Star Frontiers, but I don't remember exactly. I know it had a map that I could kind of mark my progress. We played during, I think, lunch or some other recess break. And it was just for a short while. I think it was a D6 based system or something. I don't remember what dice it used, but the basic premise was I was on a space station and trying to get back to my ship, which I guess had been, I don't think we'd know the term for the word at the time, because I was, what, maybe 8 years old? That it might have been impounded. So that was very early days, and I just kind of remember looking at a map, kind of remember rolling dice, not even all that aware if I had a character sheet or anything to go by. The same friend would later run a little D&D scenario for me, a solo scenario, speaking of, in which I played a wizard, which anybody knowing Dungeons & Dragons knows that a wizard is not a good solo character to play. There's not a whole lot of armor class, not a whole lot of combat ability, you know, you're kind of there to buff. Though I guess if you're higher level, yeah, you got those big spells that can clear a room in short order, but yeah, I don't recall caring so much about that. I had to roll, I think, a dexterity check to walk downstairs, and I failed, and so I fell down the stairs, and just don't recall enjoying it. And this was, like, early days. I think it was maybe Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. It might have even been the original deal D&D. I would later play D&D with one of my other friends later on in middle school, you know, junior high. I was introduced to, you know, rolling up a character. I've never rolled up a character before. And this is in the days of 18 over 100, and I kid you not, I rolled an 18 for strength and a 2 zeros, you know, D100 for my strength score. And that kind of became the joke of that character, is that he didn't seem to know his own strength. He'd, like, shoo away a little kid and push too hard and kill the kid. And so I really didn't enjoy that either. It seems to me that a person who's strong would know their own strength. I mean, that's kind of the whole thing around the character of Superman, is that he could crush the world pretty much, but he doesn't, because he takes caution. And why, you know, your heroic character can't know their own strength is beyond me. So, really, 3 for 3, not the best occasions for playing tabletop role-playing games. I'd go on to play more D&D. I think this was second edition. I think maybe even the 2.5 edition, where they included these subclasses, and even had books to go with them. Really nifty source books that if you were playing, say, a rogue or a cleric or something like that, there'd be subclasses from which you could choose additional abilities. It's like, oh, you're going to be a cleric? Well, let's pick your domain. You're a cleric of good and light. And so what does that offer you? Or if you're going to be a rogue, are you an acrobat, a cut purse? Are you a thug or a spy? If I recall, I played a rogue up to a point in which, for whatever reason, the dungeon master decided that we could take our current experience points and port them over to redesign our characters. And my friend Brandon, who's a cousin of another friend of mine, he is a bit of a metagamer, kind of the type to look for loopholes. And what he did is he divided up his experience points to kind of take a little bit from all these different classes to get about as high level as he could in several classes to get like tons of skills, tons of abilities, various bonuses. You know, he went multi-class with it, which is a bit of a headache thinking back to it, how difficult that would be to, you know, work out all the math and to be able to write on your character sheet all these different abilities, the point where he had all these proficiencies and different weapons and skills and whatnot. I think I went with being like a Yakuza or something like that. It's a little hazy. Remember, the campaign dealt a lot with gods and other realms, and we kept running across the deck of many things, and people would draw from it and have their soul imprisoned. It's wild, but not very memorable. This was during the era of to hit armor class zero, and they would write out on your character sheet a little chart to help you kind of do the math. I mean, 5th edition has definitely improved on that, where proficiency bonus plus your ability score modifier plus a d20 and whatever magical bonuses against somebody's armor class. That's a lot easier to work out two hit ranges rather than figuring out armor class zero when working from there. It's like, just tell us what their armor class is and what I need to hit, and have that be the same number. 5th edition, I've enjoyed a lot. I think it's really improved D&D by kind of cutting down on that weird math and doing scales and trying to figure out on a table whether you hit or not. And I like how it's introduced advantage and disadvantage as a way to deal with difficulty. If you have an advantage, roll twice, take the higher number. If you have disadvantage, roll twice and take the lower number. Instead of assigning, you know, arbitrary challenge numbers, which you can still do and is still part of Dungeons & Dragons, even in its 5th installment, of having, you know, lockpicking and having to beat maybe a 20 or 25 or whatever. 5th edition could be a bit clearer on tool proficiency and exactly what that means. Like thieves' tools, exactly what are you using the thieves' tools for? Are you using sleight of hand? Do you just do a straight-up dexterity check? You have proficiency in the tools, so you must get your proficiency bonus on top of whatever ability you're using. And this goes to all its different tools, whether it's your brewing tools, your calligraphy pen, healing kit, herbology kit. It's really not clear on how you use proficiency for tool use. I think in a later release, Xanathar's Guide to Everything might have this in it. I think they attempted to go into it, but still, I don't think it ever got really clarified exactly how to do proficiency for tools. Having dungeon mastered 5e, I find it is really easy to adapt according to what kind of campaign you want to run. There's a while when we couldn't get all the players together to play the standard campaign, I would run just some kind of offshoot thing with a fantasy version of Marvel's Avengers, in which I converted a lot of the superheroes into fantasy archetypes, like Captain America being a paladin, Scarlet Witch being a warlock, The Vision being a sorcerer, Doctor Strange being a wizard, Spider-Man being a bard, you know, that kind of thing. And there's a lot of online resources too if you're looking to get into Dungeons & Dragons. Lots of people have done homebrewing, they put up their own subclasses and monster archetypes, maybe creating their own spells. There's Roll20, and there's, I think, Dungeons & Dragons Beyond, I think it's called. But many resources for running a Dungeons & Dragons campaign. And of course you can get the books. Player's Guide has most of the stuff you need. Dungeons & Master's Guide is good, especially if you need to randomize treasure. Monster Manual's a good idea too, if you want monsters to fight. The Player's Guide has a few things in it, but mostly lower level stuff. I like the D20 system. I mean, it's kind of a go-to for most folks. If you've played Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, that role-playing game, it is based on the D20 system. The way the internal mechanics of the game work is that you have your strength, your dexterity, your constitution, your intelligence, your wisdom, your charisma. There's a number assigned to each of those, and then there's a bonus that gives you, and that kind of determines success or failure for hit rates. And then you have your own armor class. It determines whether you get hit or not. It's fascinating how adaptable Dungeons & Dragons can be. And considering how many actual play podcasts are out there doing different campaigns, different tones, different settings, different moods. You have Critical Role, you have the Adventure Zone, you have the Dice Girls. And I see so many people on Twitter, Dungeon Masters and players alike, talking about their original characters, their homebrew settings, recounting their experiences. Writer and friend Jen Williams has been playing some D&D. Freddie Morris of Nihilism Podcast is looking to get into playing some Dungeons & Dragons, running campaigns for his circle of friends. Oh, here's a fun thing, talking about Dungeons & Dragons, is that Gary Gygax had a game system, I think it was called Dangerous Voyages, I want to say. And its system is bizarre. The stats are odd. There's like a psychic stat, a mnemonic stat, which I think is supposed to be intelligence, but that's your memory. Then your physical stat. You'd roll randomly for your social economic status, and that would determine what vocations you could choose. And so you'd get certain bonuses from whatever job you had. And plus, that would determine your net worth and how much money you would make. And there's plenty of sources online regarding... Now I want to look it up again. I think Dangerous Voyages? Dangerous Journeys! Excuse me, not Voyages. Dangerous Journeys. Oh, this is post-D&D. Wow. Apparently in the early 90s it was to be a new RPG. Yeah, there's no doubt that the origins of Dungeons & Dragons were largely based on The Hobbit. Gygax being a fan of the book to the point where Tolkien's legal team had to come down on them for using Hobbit as a character class or a racial type. And so that's where we get halflings from. The tabletop role-playing game developed from, and Jim Moon of Hypnogoria does a kind of series on this, or at least talked about it a bit, is that there were basically war reenactment type games where you'd get out your miniatures and your little armies would have different stats assigned to them, and you could roll dice as kind of a randomizer effect to determine success or failure as you reenact these battles. This basic system would then be applied to your choose your own adventure style stories that were a bit more complex than just picking a choice. Your character would be given stats, and by the roll of the dice, you could determine success or failure if you were to say, try to disarm a trap or fight an ogre or something. With a bit more development, you're able to turn that concept into something more interactive rather than just the reader and the writer. Point where you could have somebody in the room weaving the story as the game master and the players making the choices and helping shape the direction the story goes into, which a decent role-playing game should be, is some concept of choice on the part of the players to determine how they want the story to go, you know, what direction they want to take it in, and the game master helping to shape and weave that world while still trying to tell the story the game master has in mind without making it feel like he's or she or they are railroading the players into a certain direction. So it's kind of a balance, really, for I think a good game is some allowance for personal freedom without absolutely going off the rails and losing the plot, so to speak, and telling a comprehensive story. I think it's helpful to have players contribute to the story in some way, to have some part in the narrative. Some players may not like that. They might want to be more of a spectator than an active participant, or kind of swept up into events larger than themselves, and just being like a small wheel in the big machine. The better dungeon masters or game masters I've had have been able to walk that line really well. And I guess I could talk about that with regards to some of these other role-playing games. I've not had a really strong Dungeons & Dragons like game master. I hope I do okay. I know I've had my own issues, especially with players that don't have the same playing style and trying to appease too many different styles of play in one setting. It's like you really need players that vibe. It's hard to balance the players that want like balls to the wall, skin of the teeth, near-death experiences and around every corner with those that want a more casual kind of narrative-based experience where death isn't always on the line and that it's more about interacting with the world rather than surviving it. I think I can also be a bit controlling, especially if there's something I have in mind that I want people to do and just kind of lean people in the direction of doing that. I think I've gotten better at that, I would hope. Let's get into some other games. We spent a long time on Dungeons & Dragons. That makes sense because it's kind of like the big behemoth of tabletop role-playing games. And considering I've played 3 or 4 versions of it, when I started getting into tabletop role-playing, there was a game released by TSR, who at the time owned Dungeons & Dragons, but it was a tabletop role-playing game based on Indiana Jones. And they had adventure packets that I would pick up at a hobby store every once in a while. And I didn't really have anybody to play this with. I did have somebody, I'd occasionally do it, but we do kind of like a lay out a map and kind of just play war kind of thing. You know, setting up the different characters across from one another, almost like a chess game, and then using the dice to perform whatever activities you do to, you know, get from one thing to another. But these were pretty cool. I still have a lot of it, I think. But yeah, the main packet came with an adventure for Raiders of the Lost Ark that you could run. And you could run this solo for yourself, because it's really... It's the problem with the Indiana Jones game is everybody would want to play Indiana Jones. Who else are you going to play? I guess you could play Short Round or Willy or, you know, somebody else, Jacques, but they don't really feature in most of the other storyline. It's really indie story, and so with regards to, you know, a solo story, I think you could work with the game master was called the narrator in this instance, and then player could play indie and just do a two-person thing. But I would alone play this, letting the dice determine success or failure for what Indy did. And these adventure packets would come with little cardboard things that you could set up, like various traps that might get set off, and various little miniatures, little triangular dudes that you could cut out and tape up so they'd be little standees for your map. Quite intricate things like sand pits that had this little punchy thing in the middle of that you could stick a dude into to show that it's sinking, or these walls that would kind of crush, and then you had walls and tables and some, you know, other kind of large furniture pieces that you could set up for miniature play. It was a percentile based system, so you'd use 2 10-sided dice and your stats were based on percentile chances. And success or failure would be determined by how well you rolled under or over your stat. The language was very much of the time, like you think having a breakthrough or being stymied. It was a neat system, just oddly so specific to Indiana Jones that it was hard to use it for anything else, really. I mean, it even had really cool flowcharts for doing car chases and random event things on the flowchart, like, you know, maybe a cart pulling in front of you, or, you know, a fruit stand in the way, or your sudden dead end. So playing with other folks, there's the whole allotment of Palladium games. You know, Kevin Symbida, and who else was involved in that? Seems to be mostly him. But he developed his own system of role-playing game. The first release by Palladium was this book called The Mechanoid Invasion. This is the first time I've been hearing about it, but it seems to indicate how they ended up with the Robotech license later. But yeah, it's a world with powerful, malevolent race of bio-driven machines that invade a planet called Gideon E. It was once colonized by humans. But following that book, he released the Palladium fantasy role-playing game, which is basically their take on the Dungeons & Dragons franchise. It also had the license for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is where I come in. When I played this, I played a Cajun Tomcat ninja. I also played in Robotech, and later the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles knockoff game Roadhogs, which is kind of based largely around the popularity of the Road Warrior, kind of post-apocalyptic California and surrounding areas, and driving around trying to get gas. But our Game Master had a different take on it, very interesting take on it. But the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles thing was kind of fun. Didn't really take off. We played a bit, but Robotech really didn't interest me. Our Game Master had a very clear idea of what he wanted, and the players weren't all that important in the great scheme of things. Sometimes it felt like we were rolling dice for him. When we transitioned from one era of Robotech to the next, he had our characters marry and have children against our own wishes, just so we could play legacy characters, which didn't interest me. I would have been perfectly fine with rolling up an entirely new character unrelated to a previous character, because I just didn't care. I just didn't feel invested. Though the source books and the game are pretty cool. What's weird about the Palladium games is that Kevin Sabida must really like strong characters, like physically strong characters, because there's a number of physical skills you can take, like athletics type skills, like if you want to take bodybuilding or running, gymnastics, acrobatics. There's just an assortment of skills you can take, physical skills you can take, that will add to your strength and other things like endurance, your physical prowess, which is like your agility, physical speed, but you could get your strength up into like the 30s. And we're talking about like a 3d6 system for generating stats, much like Dungeons & Dragons. You can see a very clear this to that. Something about the 3d6 character generated system with a lot of the Palladium games is that if you rolled a 16 or higher, you could roll d6 again and add it to be even cooler. This worked out well for our Roadhogs campaign, because if you played a family of characters, much like the Turtles in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, if you were related, those bonuses would apply to everybody. So if you were to roll a 16 on physical beauty and then roll a 5, you would get a 21, and everybody else would get that 5 added. You'd only get to add once, you know. Not all the things would stack, but whoever had the highest, I think, would be the one to stack the most. The weird thing about the friend group I played with is a lot of them didn't quite understand the rules or read them, and maybe that's my own weird obsessive compulsive thing, is reading and understanding rules and how to apply them. Is the way they were reading it, you would get all the same stat. Like if somebody had the 24, everybody'd get the 24. And it's like, no, that's not how that works. So I had to kind of show them that. Also, they were taking all their actions at once rather than make it turn-based, because you had so many actions per round. It's like, well, you get that action, then they go, then you get an action, then they go, then you get an action. So, yeah. But yeah, we played some ring-tailed cats. These are also known as Kekko missiles. I think there's some other terms for them as well, but they're related to the raccoon, and they're known for being in like this kind of region, California, Utah, Arizona, kind of more feline looking than your raccoon, but they do have a distinctive ringed tail, very large eyes, better hunters than cats, better mousers than cats, actually. And so I think they were also known as civet cats or miner's cats, because miners would keep them for keeping rats out of the mines. But yeah, we played a family of these Kekko missiles, these ring-tailed cats. We were kind of halfway between human and animal, so kind of anthropomorphized, more, well, probably even more human than that, probably like 3/4 human. Very much based on the Canadian animated film Rock and Roll. That was a large aspect of influence and inspiration for the design of our characters, even with the main brother of our group having a very hairy chest. We were mechanics in the early days. We later adapted to the Ninjas and Super Spies system to get kind of more skills and more martial arts aspects involved. And because this campaign was one of the longest running games I've ever participated in, I think we made it up to 9th level or so. My character was a full-on psychopath, somewhat high-functioning. I mean, he was violent, but it was a violent world. But it interestingly played out with the kind of leader of the group, who had kind of that obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, kind of the thing Batman has. And they're very distinct polar opposites on, you know, this personality disorder spectrum, having, you know, the antisocial personality kind of like the Joker and this obsessive-compulsive thing at the other end. So it made an interesting dynamic between those two characters. And really, at the time, I was kind of working out some things, playing kind of an evil character, a compelling character, one of the more interesting characters I played in roleplaying. But yeah, he definitely had issues. But he had his own weird, warped sense of morality, too. He didn't like to attack women. He would be brutally honest oftentimes, but he would use his charm, which was his main feature, and that was the thing he excelled at out of all the brothers, he was the most charming one, and so he'd use that to manipulate and intimidate others. Often attempt to do that rather than to actually get in physical fights, because he's also physically the weakest of them, at least strength-wise. He was a pretty good fighter. He had good agility and speed and stuff like that, but he was not physically strong. He was an albino, too, adding another aspect to it. But our Game Master is really good at action and creating scenarios. We had a war that we were fighting with another area. We became like super spies, and then we got disavowed and had to go into hiding. We'd get hired on to deliver items, smuggle items. We'd take part in underground races. It very much had the feel of the Fast and Furious franchises before even movie one was released in theaters. It just kind of had that high octane, pedal to the metal, raw machismo action adventure stuff. Just was a delight. Very fun to play. A number of other Playdium games we played. I game mastered Heroes Unlimited for a little while. Did one particular adventure where they got trapped in like a multiverse of television shows and movies and stuff like that. They had to find their way out of. I think the big conclusion to that was like at the end of Maltese Falcon when they're on the ice. And yeah, that was fun. Trying to remember a lot of the characters at the time, the players. But interesting system, superheroes done in the Playdium style. So certainly had the shortcomings of Playdium's system, which is its favoring physical strength above other things. And also the dodging bullets rather than having an armor class, because the armor class system on the Playdium games just would not work. If you just went by an armor class of 14, you'd get hit all the time, because everybody'd have so much skill in their pistol or submachine gun or anything, plus their dexterity bonus, that even the smallest roll would be enough to hit you. And then there's the rift system, which is, it's a lot. It's Palladium taking all their other properties and just jumbling up together in this multiverse scenario where worlds collide and these ley lines open up in nexus points that open portals to other worlds. And it's just, it'd be a difficult system to run. Though it's has interesting character classes. I mean, it has dimensional beings, which are like monsters coming from other realms. Juicers that are like warriors on steroids. You have crazies who are similar to the juicers. They're just genetically manipulated and it drives them insane. So you develop really cool abilities, but at the same time, every once in a while you have to roll on an insanity table, which is problematic in its own right. Glitter Boys, who are pilots of mechs that have polished kind of chrome exterior to make them resistant to laser attacks, so that's why they're called Glitter Boys. They have really big guns that they have to shoot spikes into the ground to avoid the recoil from these giant rail guns. It's a compelling world, but it's a lot when you're dealing with such a hodgepodge of different genres. It would take a skilled hand, I think, to run that as a system. But I did play a little bit of that as a crazy. Around the time we were playing Roadhogs, we were also playing Star Wars. West End Game Star Wars is a really good system. It's way simple. It uses all D6s. The more D6s you have, the better you are at the skill. If you want to do multiple actions, you move so many dice equal to those actions and then roll those. I did not create the character I played. Another scenario of me being handed a character sheet. Somebody else had already designed the character and I was just ready to go. It's like, okay, sit down, we're playing this. First time I played, I basically was an errand boy. I was a gopher. Like, we landed in a spaceport and I had to go basically with a grocery list to pick up items. My character was a gambler meets outlaw, though once again, they didn't really pay that close attention to the rules, which set stats at a certain point. They just kind of took the higher of each when they combined classes. And it was like, well, that doesn't quite work. I'm not supposed to have more D than, you know, a certain amount. I think you should have enough to have 3D in all things, I think. And then you can move them around and you can have up to a bonus of 2 pips, and then it would roll over into a full other die. And pips being little numbers on each die, so you could have a strength of like 3D plus 2, so you'd roll 3 dice 6 and then add 2. And because they're taking multiple classes and combining them and just taking the best of each stat, is like, ah, okay, I have more pips and die than I'm supposed to, so I had to kind of readjust that to get it fitting more in the rules, because I guess I'm a bit of a stickler for the rules, but yeah, trying to get it so I wasn't OP. I enjoyed playing him, even though I didn't design the character, I made him mine. We had a guy in high school that looked a lot like my Star Wars character. He had this kind of mullet and taller dude, handsome, kind of had that basketball player's build. My Star Wars character would dress kind of in a dark purple gambling outfit with a leather jacket over it. He'd wear a communicator on him at all times, so a little headset communicator. He was a bit of a sniper. His highest stat was in blaster rifle, and he'd carry a medium repeating blaster, basically a laser version of an M60 that he'd tote around. I'd get blown out into space a lot, so eventually I developed 0G combat abilities. Our game master for Star Wars, very creative individual, illustrator, comic book collector, avid reader of science fiction and fantasy, and just brought a sense of fun and wonder and grand scope to Star Wars. And if you look at Star Wars now with Book of Boba Fett and with Obi-Wan and, you know, all these Star Wars series that seem to make the universe feel smaller, the way this Game Master would run these campaigns, the scope was huge. And that's something that I think it's mentioned in the role-playing game source books, is that Star Wars is all about scope. You don't go to a desert, you go to a desert planet. You know, you don't go to the next city, you go to the next space station. You know, it's grand space opera, and he approached it like that. And speaking of the feel of things before they were released, people really loved the Firefly Serenity world. The way we played Star Wars was very much in the vein of that television series, that we were kind of a hodgepodge group of weirdos. We had a scout who was so experienced that he had some memory loss. There's talk that he might have once have been a stormtrooper and lost his memory at some point. But he had visited so many alien worlds and so many alien cultures that he developed this weird habit of adapting to wherever we went. If we were speaking to an alien, he'd adapt that alien's accent because he was just so accustomed to visiting other cultures that it became like second hand to him. But of course that would offend some people because they would think he was mocking them when he was just taking on aspects of their culture because, you know, being a scout, that's what he did. We had this Arnold Schwarzenegger-sized mofo. It was kind of the de facto leader of our group. It had some royal blood. Very big guy, like stronger than your ordinary human. Carried a larger gun than my guy even did. And we had a space pirate with us too, who very much had the personality of like Cat from Red Dwarf. And so it was quite the weird crew, but very fun, and you could just imagine playing out scenarios like in Firefly or Serenity, even the style of adventures of smuggling from here to there, breaking into places, getting inspected by Imperials, pirating, assisting the rebellion, because technically we were members of the rebellion, but we were kind of doing so in that privateer kind of fashion. If you think of pirates during the English and Spanish War, kind of had that kind of quality to us. We were really not quite in the rebellion, though we were in the rebellion. In fact, there was a time we spent on Hoth, and we were sitting in the back eating some kind of snacks and throwing them. Played one thing of Star Trek, and that system was odd. The Star Trek being very kind of science-oriented, and remember our game master had us land on an alien world and none of our communicators worked because they all broke from how we fell, and it was just kind of a bit of convenience, and it was odd, and never really went back to it. I'd be interested to play a Star Trek role-playing game now that I'm more familiar with Star Trek. Speaking of superheroes, Marvel Superheroes! Phase Rip. This was quite a odd role-playing game, but just about everybody I knew had a copy of it, including myself, of course. And I also had the expanded superpowers sourcebook. Really great sourcebook for different superpowers, including anatomical separation, where you could just be like arm fall off boy from the DC universe. But Phase Rip, fighting, agility, strength, endurance, reason, intuition, psyche. It's really odd system that dealt with columns and column shifts and difficulties, and like your stats were kind of based on these percentiles, and they were given like a superlative, like amazing is 50, incredible is 40, remarkable is 30, incredible is 20. Did I already say incredible? What was 20? I think excellent was 20. Excellent was 20, good was 10, and then monstrous was 75, unearthly was 100, and then it gets wild after that. But yeah, you had this weird white, green, yellow, and red table on the back of the source book in which you could roll your dice under whatever stat you have and determine success or failure. And, you know, if it's green, that's, you know, a decent success. Yellow is like a critical success. Red is like a super duper awesome success kind of thing. White would be a failure. Kind of color-coded opposite than what you'd think you'd be. You'd think red would be the failure. But odd system, not quite sure how the column shift thing ever quite worked, because I thought maybe you were supposed to move the column according to how easy the task was. Like, if you have an amazing intelligence and the task you're doing is actually set at incredible, that you're supposed to shift it up one, so the task is monstrous. Never did quite figure that system out. Played it for a bit with the friend, though we never really got into like a campaign kind of thing. Mostly somebody else who had the game would shuffle up the character cards and break out a map, and we basically kind of play like a kind of one-on-one battle between the two of them. Be kind of sucky if you got like a Hawkeye versus the Hulk kind of thing, but setting two Marvel characters against each other in a like fantasy what-if smash, you know, who will win kind of scenario. Another kind of mech warrior type game was it Battletech or Mech Warrior that I played? I think it was Battletech. This was an odd system where we just land on a planet, fight some other group of mechs, and then go to the next planet, fight a bunch of mechs. There wasn't really a story to it. I do recall that we had a big old spreadsheet to make sure that our mercenary group was in the black. So they actually did create a spreadsheet on the computer to track our wages. And I remember our team leader getting upset when I had a rocket launcher that the rockets were costing too much money. I liked my mech. It was called the Stainless Steel Provider. It had these cool jump jets so I could jump around, and had these things called heat sinks that were used to determine how much you could do in one round of combat. You know, fire this weapon, fire that weapon, and move this many spaces, and that's what your heat sinks could absorb, and any more than that and you'd overheat. So an interesting way to measure how many actions you can take, but it didn't really have any story. It was just kind of a fun, like, back to basics tabletop battle simulator, but with giant robots. Probably the game I was most suited for game mastering was Toon. This was one of the GURPS games, one of the many Steve Jackson games, Steve Jackson being one of these names going back to, like, the original choose-your-own-adventure style books. Now, GURPS is the generic universal role-playing system. I believe it's 2d6 system, but Toon was the GURPS system based on playing cartoons in a cartoon show. This was hella fun. I have been a fan of animation and cartoons for, like, ever. Grew up watching Tom and Jerry and the Merry Melodies and Looney Tunes and, of course, the Mickey Mouse shorts and other Saturday morning cartoons, but mostly, like, the madcap, way out there stuff that Warner Brothers and to some part Disney was doing, you know, especially if you look at the Goofy shorts. They got pretty madcap at times. Well, Donald wasn't far off either. Things get pretty wild with all of them, I suppose. But yeah, it was well suited for running that system, and it was a good before we play something else thing to get kind of the goofiness out of your system, playing something very goofy indeed. And it was easy to come up with a scenario. It's like, oh, you guys are at a ski lodge, and just go from there, doing whatever scenarios. You know, you have the whole better off dead challenge you to a race kind of scenario. You could have avalanche rescue stuff. Just any scenario you can think of, just as wild and humorous as you intend to, and play it all like you were just doing an episode of a cartoon with the same cast of characters. And so it's kind of a nice reset button, because then you go into the next thing and your rabbit is now a detective, or your rabbit is now working in a factory. Finally, while a lot of my usual circle of friends that we would roleplay, you know, together went off on their missions, being Utah and all, I ran for some younger friends Cyberpunk. Cyberpunk 2020, which is the same Cyberpunk the notorious video game is designed after. It's, in fact, the same universe of Cyberpunk 2020, which kind of explains how odd 2077 is, that it seems very much rooted still in 1980s culture and the 1980s concept of cyberpunk and what that is. And that's why you get a lot of nods to stuff like Blade Runner. So if you're familiar with Cyberpunk 2077, Cyberpunk 2020 was very much like that. You could play different kind of classes. You did have your solos, your netrunners, riggers who would be able to control vehicles with their cybernetics, fixers who were kind of the gangsters of the universe that were able to set up deals and that sort of thing, your cyber samurai. I enjoyed running Cyberpunk. It's a genre I understand. I've been a fan of cyberpunk films for a long time. Even read some cyberpunk fiction. I read Neuromancer. Kind of get what it's all about, the dystopian future and the whole cyber being computers and technology of that sort, and punk being your street person, and you combine the two of them. You have a street person who has access to high technology, and that's basically the jumping off point for doing
something like Westworld or Blade Runner.
One of the things unique to the way I did Cyberpunk is anytime people would run across normies, which be this puritanical group of anti-implant individuals. They were just straight human, and they had something kind of cultish about them, and I always made them a bit powerful, and a lot of them were experts in, like, martial arts or developing the human body to peak performance through natural means, because, you know, they were so focused on that rather than getting implants, that anybody who ran across somebody without any implants at all is, you know, they'd think twice about doing anything about it. And paranoia was definitely a thing I had going on. Just about any little thing had my players second guessing. Because that's kind of the world it was, you know, that anybody any time could probably stab you in the back and not know who to trust. Source book is a bit odd because a lot of the art was like somebody took, and this is fine, artists do this all the time, but taking from it like some other source and tweaking it to look like something else, like an album cover for Big Audio Dynamite, and just adjusting the clothing a bit to look different, to be like some cyberpunk gang.
Speaking of cyberpunk, I did roll up a character for Shadowrun. That's a system that intrigues me in that it combines cyberpunk future technology with the use of magic and spirituality and stuff like that. But I kind of side-eye how that is accomplished, in that, you know, the folklore, the premise behind Shadowrun really mystifies and fetishizes Native American culture by having this return to nature and somehow magic, shamanism, that sort of thing. And if it was just that, if it just combined magic and technology without bringing in the weird cultural parts of it, because I don't think they had any First Nations persons involved in the original creation of the system. But like I said, I do like the feel of what a system like that would be like if you could get away from, you know, cultural appropriation and that sort of thing. I rolled up, I think, a Netrunner that I never played.
I briefly played the Serenity role-playing game, but barely didn't enjoy the experience. It's not the fault of the game, it's just who we were playing with and who was running the system. It's also one of these scenarios of the game master saying, hey, you can play whatever you want, and then Brandy wanting to play as a companion, which is a perfectly reasonable ask in the Firefly Serenity world, especially if you're a woman, because that seems to be a role very much carved out for a female character. And then having your game master be a bit iffy when it came to female sexuality, that, you know, didn't know how to quite weave that into the narrative, when really it shouldn't be that hard. Also playing with someone who treats role-playing as a competitive thing, like they have to be the one doing everything, and so you never quite get a turn in, you never get quite get your part of the narrative, that the player is always demanding the attention of the game master to investigate or to do this or that thing. And so it really felt just kind of like I was sitting there doing nothing, so never really went back to that. So it seems like an interesting system in that it uses different dice for different abilities. Like there's your D12s, your D10s, your D8s, and it's kind of odd. I think there is a role-playing system developed, I think, after Stranger Things, kind of inspired by Stranger Things, called Kids on Bikes. And that also seems to have this system of having your abilities be D20, D12, D10, D8, D6 and D4, and, you know, how you arrange those or how good you are at each, you know, D4 being your least likely ability. Haven't played that. Rolled up a lot of characters for role-playing games I never played.
Just kind of wishful thinking that happens sometimes. People get a game system and they're excited to roll up characters, and then it seems like nobody wants to actually run the game. Everybody wants to play the game, so you all have these characters you rolled up and then nothing to do with them. So we did a, I think Palladium had a horror themed role-playing game. We rolled up characters for that. I think I was a psychic sensitive in that. Haven't played Call of Cthulhu. Haven't played Fate. Isn't there another one called Monster of the Week or something like that? Haven't played that one, though its system is intriguing. You know, there's a lot of one-pagers out there. Lasers and Feelings, Honey Heist. Kind of fun, just weird campaign scenarios and a really simple system. Car Wars, that's an interesting one. Kind of also somewhat based around your Death Race 2000, Road Warrior, Mad Max kind of thing, where cars would battle each other. What was great about Car Wars is its system helped with the Game Master for our Roadhogs campaign to work out how street combat would work, how, you know, fishtailing and T-boning and rear-ending and sideswiping and all that stuff. Even though there were some rules already kind of worked into the Roadhogs game, that using Car Wars as an additional source helped kind of illustrate exactly how a lot of street combat would play out. I tried creating my own system, but it just got too complex. It was too like Rifts being too much of everything. Really, it's kind of nice to focus on one thing. Though I like the idea of a system like 5th edition where you can craft and mold it to fit the setting you want. Though even Dungeons & Dragons, you know, 5th edition has its own issues. It's like, what's the difference really between perception and insight and investigation? And, you know, really just subtle differences between different skill sets. It's like persuasion and deception is like, okay, are you lying to them? Then I guess it's deception. Are you telling the truth in an urgent fashion? Is that persuasion? So even as good as a game as 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons is, it's, you know, still has its problems. Yeah, the system I was designing had way too many stats. It had 12 distinct stats, rather than your 6 for Dungeons & Dragons, you know, like twice the number of stats. It's like, do you really need that many? I like how Disco Elysium approaches kind of this tabletop role-playing manner and how it has its skill sets and stats and the thought cabinet and how it's a 2d6 system and has its own challenge ratings for difficulty, and to see that play out on screen, you know, success and failures, and white checks and red checks and all that stuff. So be interesting to do Disco Elysium as a role-playing game. So it's an interesting world, but I'm not sure how you'd play out the thought cabinet in a role-playing game fashion. I did purchase back in the day the rule book for a tabletop role-playing game called Underground. And I had my eye on this for a while, is that it dealt with superheroes and combined it with like social commentary and politics and stuff like that. And it seemed to have kind of a hard edge to it, and I was kind of a hard-edged sort of person at the time. But the result was a game I thought was pretty much unplayable in the setting that it presented. The game's called Underground, and it's kind of like an American take on 2000 AD, you know, like a Judge Dredd kind of universe, where fascism has overtaken America. I think David Duke is president, and even then that was a dated reference. There's a lot of Reaganomics, you know, Ronald Reagan era 80s nationalism that permeates the source book in, you know, a cynical fashion. But, you know, in the 90s already, that was starting to be something of the past. And also presenting fallout from stuff like overpopulation and deregulation so that cannibalism was popularized, and one of the most well-known fast food chains was called Tasty Ghoul, because before your demise, you could sign away your body to be, instead of interred or cremated or something, that you could be reprocessed into food. And the core of the game is that you would play these veteran superheroes that were given a super soldier serum sort of thing, and then paid to fight in corporate wars. And when your tour of duty ended, you became a veteran, that you'd be just put on these paltry VA benefits, and because you had this super soldier serum, you'd have to receive some medication for that, lest you go insane or have some kind of other reaction from not keeping up with your new super abilities. It was kind of a world that was hard to manage. I did try running a campaign. It just didn't seem to work. It was hard to play in a world that was already so far a parody that it didn't leave much for players to deal with it. I get that same kind of sense from Paranoia, which seems to run counter to how I think role-playing should go, where players would actively be plotting against one another so they could survive that campaign or that scenario. The whole premise of Paranoia being that you have these series of clones and you exist in this dystopian future wherein fear is such a motivator that you can't pretty much trust anyone. And then to have mad computers telling you to take out your fellow humans or your other clones. So yeah, Underground, difficult system to play and was already outdated at time of release, and tried to capture that spirit of the 2000 AD comic without the British sensibilities. You know, that precise wit and knack for social commentary. Oh, anyhow, I think I've just talked your ears off regarding all the different tabletop role-playing games I've played. Kind of touched upon what makes a good game master, what makes a bad. Good and bad players. Metagamers. I can be a metagamer myself, looking to, you know, min-max my characters. Like, what doesn't my character need? What do they need? But at the same time, I could play something more authentic, and whatever character the dice gives me, to play them as, you know, straight down the middle as possible. Matt Arnold of Dungeons & Daddies is an interesting role player in that regard, is that he very much looks at what the character would do, as opposed to what he, the player, knows, what his character knows, what his character would do, as opposed to what he, the player, would do, can be two different things. And that's an interesting take, where you're actually playing a role, that you're looking at your character as a separate entity to you, who knows different things than you, that has different fears and desires than you, and so will be differently motivated than you. It's an interesting way to play. Well, there's other folks that play more akin to their own desires, and it becomes like a power fantasy where you want to insert yourself into a game and kind of play as you would want to. So you're basically playing the character as you. Competitive role players, yeah. Sometimes a player might be a little too creative, and I've heard many instances of this, of the person in the D&D party that wants to play a glassblower, and that's basically what they do, is they devote their time to becoming a glassblower, living in a small town, blowing glass, not going out on adventures or anything like that, just pouring everything into this aspect of glassblowing, which I don't quite understand. It's like, you could do that as a hobby if you're so interested. Why would you do that in a fantasy aspect? Players that always play a ninja, players that always play a zombie of some sort. Talked briefly about the competitive player, the player that acts like it's a competition and they have to succeed at everything. I found as a player, I was a type to, and I do this while watching movies and television and stuff too, is to use my intuition to kind of guess certain outcomes. And it's surprising how often I might be correct. But you pick up on subtle clues, you hear somebody rummaging upstairs, and there are certain omission of details that leads one to conclude that whoever's rummaging upstairs isn't, you know, who you might assume them to be. And you think, okay, this is could be a potential enemy, it could be a potential friend. So yeah, just drawing conclusions from whatever clues the game master provides, rather willingly or unconsciously. A lot of these games are still available. You could probably pick them up through eBay, or some of them might have other releases. I did have a preview of Marvel's intended next role-playing game, and I did not like it at all. I think it's too combat-focused to the detriment of anything else, that it seems more like Fortnite or Team Fortress characters than multifaceted role-playing characters. You know, something where there could be non-player interaction and building up a greater storyline. No, they're all seem to be, for the most part, geared towards fighting in some aspect or another, whether you're a ranged weapons expert or you're a tank or you're the tactical combatant, and the power system was a bit of a headache. All right, I guess I'll end there. I can't think of any other role-playing games to think of. I've played a lot of them. Enjoyed some. The ones that we spent the most time playing are clearly the ones we most enjoyed, and so there's a reason for that. That the setting, the game master, the characters, they all fit in such a fashion that it just worked. That to the point where later movies would have the feel of our game sessions. It's kind of telling. So if you're a role player, I hope you've enjoyed this and kind of share and commiserate in some of my experiences with these different systems. Or if you're looking to start a gaming group of your own, maybe some of these might appeal to you. You know, Vampire the Masquerade is another one. I rolled up a character I never played. Had kind of a Nosferatu type character. Interesting system that was made available for free online a while ago, and I downloaded it. Not that I anticipate ever playing it, but it has its own rich lore, and I know is popular amongst particularly gothic folks, but not just limited to them. So anyhow, I was supposed to end talking about all this stuff, but anyhow, yeah, if any of these games interest you, maybe check them out. So that, I'll leave it, and try to think of something else to hit you up with the other standard episode for this month. Take care. Bye.
You have been listening to the Dark Corner Podcast with me, Brandy, and also David Jackola. Follow me on Twitter at BrandyWine12. Brandy is spelled with an I. Dave is at Dark Corner Cast. We have a group and a fan page on Facebook. Both are at the Dark Corner Podcast. Please subscribe to the podcasts Boldly Go, a Strange New Worlds podcast, The Vedic Assembly, a Deep Space Nine podcast, and What the Future Holds, a Star Trek Discovery podcast. You can see me discuss Star Trek live on the Unready Room and the Kurt Ratz Productions YouTube channel. Kurt Ratz is Star Trek spelled backwards. I host my own podcast, Headcanon, wherein I guide you through the mazes of my mind. The Dark Track was offered for free as a promotional item or is submitted by the artist or artist representative. The opening track is Unbelievable, as covered by Batavia. The closing track is At Last the End, as covered by Cat Temper. All other music is used for illustrative purposes and no infringement of copyright is intended. Please subscribe, rate, and review the Dark Corner Podcast on anchor.fm. And thank you for allowing us the time to keep you in the dark.
The Dark Corner.